trustees and students. I'm so pleased you could join us for this event as part of the Day of Engagement preceding my formal inauguration ceremony. I am Maria Gallo, and I have been serving as chancellor here at UW-River Falls since July of 2021. It's my pleasure to provide a few introductory remarks to start things off. Before I introduce our guests, I'd like to acknowledge the Tommy G. Thompson Center on Public Leadership, which has generously sponsored this event. For those unfamiliar with the Thompson Center, it was established to follow in the footsteps of former Wisconsin Governor Tommy Thompson, known for working with colleagues on both sides of the aisle to advance the public good. The Thompson Center seeks to carry on this legacy by conducting activities across all UW campuses to inform and inspire current and future public leaders, foster leadership skills, and promote effective public leadership. The center offers free public events, funds research and scholarships, and honors exemplary public leaders. More information on the center and their upcoming events and grant opportunities is available on their website. On behalf of UW-River Falls, my heartfelt thank you to the Thompson Center and to their staff who have helped make this event possible. In planning for my inauguration, I began thinking months ago about themes and priorities that I wanted to weave into the event. When I read The Extended Mind, I knew that the message of that book would have to play a role. As an academic, scientist, and administrator, I was used to conceiving of intelligence as being based solely in the human brain. Annie Murphy-Paul inspired me to start thinking outside the brain, a concept I couldn't wait to share with campus. That is why I'm so excited to have author Annie Murphy-Paul here with us this evening. Annie is an acclaimed science writer whose work has appeared in the New York Times Magazine, Scientific American, The Best American Science Writing, and many other publications. Her book, The Extended Mind, The Power of Thinking Outside the Brain, was published in June 2021 and has already won numerous accolades. Annie is a recipient of the Rosalind Carter Mental Health Journalism Fellowship, the Spencer Education Journalism Fellowship, and the Bernard L. Schwartz Fellowship at New America. She also has a TED Talk that has been viewed more than 2.6 million times. A graduate of Yale University and Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism, she is currently a Learning Sciences Exchange Fellow at North America. Also here tonight is Kathy Werzer, who has graciously agreed to lead us in what should be a very engaging conversation with Annie. Kathy is a 1992 UWRF graduate with a degree in broadcast journalism and urban studies. She received the UWRF Distinguished Alumnus Award in 2018 and has served on the UWRF Foundation Board of Directors. Kathy is host of Morning Edition on Minnesota Public Radio and also hosts their noontime program, Minnesota Now. Since 1994, Kathy has co-hosted the weekly public affairs program Almanac on Twin Cities Public Television, for which she has earned 4 regional Emmy Awards. To honor Kathy's successful career as a reporter, news anchor, and producer, she was inducted into the Minnesota Broadcasting Hall of Fame this past September. And now, let's welcome Annie Murphy-Paul and Kathy Werzer to the stage.
Oh, nice. So nice to actually see people.
Real people.
You know, real people. I like that a lot. You know, when Chancellor Gallo and I talked about tonight's gathering and why she was so interested in having a conversation with Annie Murphy-Paul as a key inaugural event, I thought, fantastic idea. I love the idea. One of the nation's most respected science writers talking about new ways of thinking in an institution dedicated to expanding minds and knowledge. So I'm so happy to be here. I'd also like to welcome our live audience here at the Student Center on campus. Special hello to folks listening to this live broadcast on WRFW-FM, the campus radio station, my alma mater. on air and online at WRFW887.com. We also have a video stream of this conversation, so hello to our virtual audience. Annie Paul, so happy you made the trip from Connecticut. Welcome to Wisconsin.
Oh, I'm so happy to be here, Kathy. Thank you.
I have to say, the book covers a lot of ground. The lead, the nut of this story is research shows that thinking happens beyond the brain. Learning happens in our bodies, throughout our spaces, in our interactions with others, which I bet might make some people's heads explode, you know? How big of an aha was this for you when you started the research?
Yeah, it was a big aha moment, and I can remember exactly when it happened. I actually had been reporting on and writing about the science of learning for a number of years. You know, I don't know if you've ever heard the phrase that research is me-search, but this was definitely me-search because I had a couple of kids who had started school, and I was so interested in how they were learning and how their teachers were teaching them, and at the same time, discovering that the science of learning was this booming, exciting, dynamic field with all these fascinating findings coming out. But what I lacked at that point, I had the idea that I wanted to write about all of this in a book, but what I lacked was a big idea that would pull it all together and hopefully be an idea that might change the way we see things. That's what I love as a reader, and that's what I look for as a writer. And so having not found the idea in the research that I was doing, I sort of broadened my reading and the ambit of my research, and that's how I ended up reading a philosophy journal, of all things, and came across an article titled The Extended Mind. It was published in 1998, by two philosophers, Andy Clark and David Chalmers. And this article grabbed me from the very first line, which the first line of it read, "Where does the mind stop and the rest of the world begin?" And that would seem like such a provocative question to me, in part because it would seem to have an obvious answer or a conventional answer, which is, well, the mind stops at the skull, right? I mean, the mind is the brain, the mind is pretty much identical with the brain, right? But Clark and Chalmers were saying, no, that's wrong. Actually, the mind extends beyond the brain into the gestures and movements of our bodies, into the spaces in which we think and learn, into our relationships with other people, and into our tools and our devices that we use, and all of these extra neural resources, these outside the brain resources, help us do our thinking. And if we imagine that intelligence is just a lump of stuff that's sealed inside our heads, we're missing all the richness of the ways that the world around us contributes to our thinking. So that was, reading that article was the big aha moment for me. And then it was just another, you know, 4 or 5 years to actually figure out what it would mean to write about it in book form.
I think the most fascinating information in this book is, for me at least, revolves around the role of the body. Mm-hmm. In thinking, right? Mm-hmm. It's almost as if you're talking about full body mm-hmm. learning, mm-hmm. in a sense. Mm-hmm. So how does one think with one's body?
Yeah, well, Kathy and I backstage were talking about gesturing and how Kathy is a gesturer, I am too, and how it comes so naturally to us to move our hands around when we speak. But so often gesture, to take one kind of thinking with the body, is stigmatized or dismissed as unimportant or even kind of distracting, when in fact research shows, and this is part of what I write about in the book, that our gestures are actually a few milliseconds ahead of what we're saying verbally in terms of the ideas that they're expressing. And it can even help us to formulate our thoughts in words, to be feeling and watching our own hands moving in ways that are relevant to what we're thinking about. So actually, we want to be gesturing ourselves. We want to be encouraging our students to gesture as much as possible, because a really thorough understanding and a really complete articulation of what we're saying isn't possible without, well, it's much more difficult without our hands. And Kathy was telling me, I hope I don't.
It's okay. You can.
She had
it's
a.
It's embarrassing.
A mentor,
but go ahead.
It was the CBS
TV network. consultant when I worked at WCCO-TV. And you just have seen me use my hands already, right? And so she said, absolutely not. Never use your hands. You sit on your hands. You're an anchor. You never use your hands. And for me, and when I'm on radio on NPR, my hands are flying like I'm conducting a symphony orchestra. So it's really hard. And she said, it's distracting. Viewers will hate it. So I sat there on my hands, literally. So if you see those first few newscasts, it was just so painful. But I said to you, I use my hands to like pull out the ideas, because when you're doing stand-ups or some of your reports, you know, you've got this information in your head that you need to clearly and concisely impart to viewers. And when I use my hands, it comes more naturally to me. So thank you for putting in the book props to those of us who use our hands.
Yes.
So it's interesting that the body is actually responding a little faster than the mind is.
Exactly, exactly. And we're so brain focused, so neurocentric in our society. I mean, we really kind of almost fetishize or idealize the brain as the center of intelligence and intelligent thinking, when really the body has its own intelligence that we're leaving out, we're not taking advantage of when we think of, when we imagine that thinking and learning happen sitting still, you know, which is still the model. It remains the model of a lot of that pervades our education system, even our workplace too. You know, if you have something you need to get done, what do? You lock yourself alone in a room and you stay still and you work your brain until it's done. But in fact, that is cutting yourself off from all these other outside the brain resources that you could be pulling into your thinking, like movement, like a change of scene, like getting outside, like talking with other people. And so I wrote The Extended Mind in part to remind people that we think with all of those parts of ourselves and all of those parts of the world, and not just with the brain alone.
By the way, when you arrived on campus, did you take a walk to clear your head before our conversation?
I did actually get to walk through campus. It's a very beautiful campus. It's a beautiful time of year, so I did enjoy that.
Okay, which centers you?
Yeah, you know, I found when I was writing the book that if I worked in the morning, and then I was, at the time, I was really into bike riding. It was not a walk, but a bike ride. That it was really the research on this book in action, because I not only was able to solve problems and see things more clearly, there was also a kind of almost like a motivational element of it, in the sense that when we're moving forward in a fluid kind of way, that's the metaphor that our brain uses to apply to whatever we're thinking about. So, and of course, I was out in nature as well, which, as I report in the book, has an attention restoration effect, such that you know, we think so much about where to direct our attention, how to manage our attention, but we don't think so much about refilling the tank of our attention, you know, replenishing our attention. And it turns out that the best way to do that is to, and the easiest way to do that is to go outside and spend some time in nature. So those three elements, you know, getting away from my screen and my computer, having that forward motion and impetus, and then being in nature, they really, so many ideas came to me, so many problems were solved on those bike rides. So I was really, you know, trying to walk the walk, so to speak, of what the book says.
I wonder if there are professors here, working professors. You might want to consider your next lecture a walking lecture, given what you were writing about. It was actually quite interesting that you students absorb more information when they're moving.
Right. And it's really, we could be building movement into our school days, our work days, so so easily, but we just tend, it's really more about a bias, a prejudice in favor of being still, of being alone, of sort of hunkering down and relying on the brain, that we just don't think of, say, walking across campus as we conduct a small seminar. I think that would be a great thing to try.
But can you explain just scientifically here how movement helps us learn?
Yeah, so there's a couple different ways, and in the book I lay out three different kinds of movement. There's gesture, of course, as we've been talking about, but then there's low intensity movement, which helps to keep us alert, and that can even be something like fidgeting, you know, and fidgeting, again, is something we have a bias against. We think it's distracting, or even someone who fidgets is a little shifty or something, you know, so we have these biases against fidgeting, but it turns out that fidgeting is a very finely modulated way of adjusting our level of arousal and alertness. And I think we've all had those moments when you've been sitting at your desk for a while and you haven't been moving very much, and you start to you know fall asleep at your desk. Fidgeting can be a way to keep yourself alert in a boring meeting, or you know, it could also be a way to sort of play and have an expansive and creative kind of mindset, because you're playing with an object as you're doing your thinking. So there's that really low intensity movement, which also can be implemented just by working at a standing desk, for example, because we tend, when we're standing, we shift our weight from one foot to another, or we move our arms around a bit more. It's really when we're sitting that we end up being in this sort of a sort of torpor, where we don't have the blood, you know, pumping to our brains. We don't have a movement that's keeping us alert and awake. So then there's a sort of moderate level of activity. And my favorite example of this is recess, you know, for school children. That any teacher will tell you that when kids are antsy or when they're restless or getting bored, when they can go out and run around outside and get that, you know, a few minutes of moderate activity, that they come back refreshed and ready to focus, you know, and that goes for us adults too. And then finally, there's really high intensity activity that can actually put us into a state of extreme creativity and open-mindedness. You know, when you have to focus so much on, like if you're training for a marathon or working out very intensely. The prefrontal cortex, the part of the brain that makes judgments and is kind of our inner critic, goes offline temporarily. It becomes less active because so many mental resources are devoted to engaging in that very vigorous physical activity. And then when we're in that state, that hypoactive state of that's induced by this really intense exercise, it's almost a dreamlike state or even like a drug trip. Scientists have compared it to that, where ideas and impressions can mingle and collide and combine in new ways. Mm-hmm. So some people have found that they have their best ideas when they're, you know, when they're sort of pounding the pavement as a runner.
That's true. I've heard that, you mm-hmm. know. Thank you, by the way, for writing at length, and I'm concentrating on the role of the body right now, because mm-hmm. I do think it's interesting. Thank you for writing at length about gut feel. You know, I thought the research into the stock traders was fascinating, mm-hmm. that we tend to ignore gut feel, mm-hmm. but it's actually quite accurate, mm-hmm. and can help you, mm-hmm. which I was quite surprised to learn, think mm-hmm. and make decisions, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and they're accurate.
Yeah, yeah. And it does come as a surprise because, again, in our culture, we have this tendency to separate mind and body, you know, and to often elevate mind and to assume that body has nothing to contribute to intelligent thinking. But in fact, the body often knows more than the conscious mind is able to access. So as we make our way through our everyday lives, we're taking in so much information, far more information than we could ever process on a conscious level, but on a non-conscious level, our minds are taking note of all that we experience and noting patterns and storing them for later reference. And that's a treasure trove of information that can inform our judgments, but then how do we have access to that information if it's non-conscious? And the answer is the body. It's the body that tells us through very subtle signals that this is a situation that we've encountered before, that there's something we need to pay attention to here.
Is this called interoception?
Yeah, so this capacity called interoception, which just refers to the fact that just like we have sensors that pull in information from the outside world, you know, we smell and we see and we hear things, we have sensors on the insides of our body that are sending us this constant flow of information from within the body. And what's interesting to me is that we're often taught that when we need to do real work or real serious thinking, we need to push the body aside. You know, I need to power through. I need to not notice that I'm hungry or tired or, you know, feeling something inside of me. When really, if we were able to tune into our interoceptive sensations, that flow of internal sensation, that carries a lot of information that could really helpfully inform our thinking.
So is interoception almost like another sensory system, mm-hmm. like hearing, sight, taste?
Yes, just from within. And of course, there's so much information and so much stimuli always, you know, competing for our attention out here in the world that we sometimes forget to tune into the quieter, more subtle flow of information that's within, but we can learn to do that and remember to do that.
You know, you wrote in the book, changing what the body does can change our feelings, perceptions, and thoughts. And I was wondering, when I read that and read through the book, how might those who are living with a physical disability and find it difficult, if not impossible, to change what their body can do, how might they experience the extended mind differently? Any research on that at all?
That's a really interesting question, Kathy. I am not sure. I know that, you know, this is a theme that comes up often in the book, that we have this metaphor whereby we compare the brain to a computer, and it's... Or a muscle, right. And these are fruitful metaphors in many ways, but they're also limiting. And so a computer doesn't have a body. A computer isn't so sensitive to context the way, to our surroundings, the way human beings are. So I would imagine that a person whose body it lives in the world differently has different kinds of thoughts, you know. And but I think that would be a super interesting thing to investigate.
So we've spent a lot of time talking about the body. Given your research, you mentioned this, touched on this a little bit. Workplaces and schools are hotbeds of unproductive habits. That should come as no shock to anybody here in this room, I'm sure.
Yes.
So let's talk about using spaces for thinking. And with the pandemic, of course, we've seen open offices and hoteling, which is, you know, you don't have it at your own desk. You can just take whatever's here and just do your work and get the heck out of here and go home. Given your research, that's not a great move.
Yeah, I think we're all sort of figuring out what this new world of work will look like, and I'm hoping that whatever comes out of this will be informed by the research that suggests a couple of different things. One is that we do need a protected space to do very deep, complicated, complex thinking, because the human brain didn't really evolve to do that kind of very high-level abstract cognition. So we need as much help as we can give it, and that often includes or involves walls, you know, that protect us from the very kinds of stimuli that are most distracting for us, which, because we're social creatures, are the social stimuli of people talking, people moving around, people appearing in our sight, which of course is what you see and hear all around you in an open office. But then at the same time, we need at other moments to extend our minds with the minds of other people. And so there's an interesting body of research that that suggests that something called intermittent collaboration is the best way to go, that we want to have that protected space for our deep work, but then also have spaces that support, you know, very dynamic and collegial kind of collaboration. And so I've wondered if the new kind of hybrid workplaces that many of us are participating in, where we work at home sometimes and then go into the office sometimes, could support that really effectively. What if our homes was that protected place where we can, you know, kids and pets aside, like, but, you know, have quiet time to focus on our work. And then when we go into work, that's our moment for collaborating and meeting up with people and engaging in that socially extended mind.
I like, could you go into a little more depth on the socially extended mind, mm-hmm. thinking with others. Mm-hmm. Those of us who are a bit of maybe lone wolves, mm-hmm. and you're mm-hmm. freelancers, you mm-hmm. know, that's could be kind of a difficult concept, right? But it's fascinating that you're it's not group think, it's group mind. You
yes.
mentioned that.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And I recently got my first job in 20 years. I had been freelance for many years before
We've got to tell folks what you're doing. I'm so proud of her. You all remember Hidden Brain, Shankar Vedantam on National Public Radio? And he's working with Shankar on Hidden Brain, which is great.
Yeah, so I've joined Kathy in the broadcast world, and it's super fun and interesting. But where was I going?
I'm
with
terribly
that?
Sorry to interrupt you. You were talking about you've been a freelancer for a number
yes,
of years.
Yes, right. So I have been a very solitary worker, and I do tend in that direction. But I was really kind of persuaded by the research that I pulled together in that chapter that you're referencing, Kathy, about the group mind and how we create what psychologists call, and this is really a term, groupiness. How do you take an assemblage of individuals and create a process whereby they feel themselves to be a group, to be an entity unto themselves? And it turns out that really the best way to do that is all of the best ways to do that involve being in the same place at the same time, often doing the same things together. This is how human beings have always created bonds and created that kind of mental mind meld where you're on the same page mentally. So, for example, learning together in the same place at the same time, training together, that doesn't always happen. You know, one of the clearest examples of that is like in hospitals where people from all these different disciplines, you know, pharmacists and nurses and surgeons and anesthetists, anesthesiologists all have to work together, but they've often been trained separately, even in separate institutions. So now, fortunately, in the healthcare field, people are from different disciplines are often are more often training together. But that's one way to create a group mind, a feeling of groupiness. Another is to engage in rituals together, even if that's just something as simple as eating a meal together or taking a walk together. It turns out that when people walk together, they tend to synchronize their movement. And we know that synchronized movement, and I'm not saying that everyone needs to, you know, go to a rave together or do karaoke together, but synchronized movement is a very age-old way of bonding people together. And then finally, having emotional or meaningful experiences together in the same place at the same time can really create emotional bonds and also that sort of mental connection whereby people are on the same page. So I'm a big fan now of, I've been persuaded that to create that feeling of groupiness, we really need to be together and not looking at each other on the screen.
Mm. So really, employers that want to bring workers back into the office using the concept of groupiness, I mean, then it makes sense, I guess.
Yeah, I think we can be intentional about it, and we can also respect the fact that many people have found that working at home or working remotely is a very productive way for them to work. It's just there is something that is lost there. I recently ran across some research that suggests that two things in particular suffer when a work group is remote rather than in person together. One is that a sense of, over time, the trust among the people in that group goes down because you just can't get as granular a sense of the other people that you're working with when you're really only seeing them on a screen for a few hours a week. So trust tends to decline, and the younger people in the workplace tend to suffer because so much of what you learn as a young person starting out in a profession is this implicit knowledge that nobody's really telling it to you directly. I'm sure you had this experience, Kathy, as a young reporter. Just by watching, just by seeing what's going on around you, just by absorbing it, and it's very hard for young people to get that when they're working from their spare bedroom. So I think that's something we really got to keep our eye on in terms of making sure that young people have that on the ground, in-person experience.
To that end, also you talked, and I'm glad you did, in the book about storytelling, the value mm-hmm. of storytelling mm-hmm. in a space, in a workspace. Mm-hmm. And you've all done this, I'm sure. the most productive conversations, the most productive information that's shared is not done formally. It's
right.
in conversation.
Right.
People, my mom's a nurse anesthetist, so she often tells stories of the worst cases she's had.
Mm-hmm.
But younger nurse anesthetists just hang on her every word. Well,
right.
How did you pull him through that?
Right, right.
Right. And so it's actually very interesting information, and the takeaways are quite valuable.
Totally, yeah. And those kinds of stories that your mother tells are full of what's called tacit information, like how you handle when this happens, what do you do next? You know, the kinds of information that is really, it's hard to put into words, and also it's hard to give any young person or beginner a sense of every, they're not going to have encountered every potential scenario, but they can hear about all those scenarios and what an expert, a master at their craft, you know, did in response. And what's nice about storytelling is that people are so naturally inclined to tell stories that all you really have to do as a leader or manager is make space and make time for people to tell stories and to treat that storytelling not as wasted, you know, gossip or whatever, but really as crucial information sharing of the most valuable kind.
And so getting back, you're probably not going to find those opportunities via screen.
Right, right.
Because
we get on, we get off, we don't,
sure.
Right, we don't tend to, we're not sitting around having a cup of coffee together.
So getting back to spaces, mm-hmm. because we are in an institution of higher learning, remote, I guess you'd have to say remote and online learning are here to stay, right? But I'm wondering, as institutions look at the right combination of remote and in-person learning, which would deliver the highest educational quality and equity,
mm-hmm.
do you think this might be a once-in-a-generation opportunity to rethink the use of physical and virtual space at a university?
I think that's right. And I hear people in the higher education sphere talking that way because in many cases, spaces have been freed up. There's maybe not as many students attending in person. They have more flexibility in how they use their space. Excuse me. Oh, sorry. So I do think it's exactly what you said, Kathy. It's an opportunity to think very intentionally about how are our spaces supporting learning or not, you know, and how can we reinvent them to create the most welcoming, the most effective, the most functional kinds of spaces. And one thing I want to mention there is the research on what we see when we enter a space, you know, and what that tells us about whether we belong there, what kind of things we're going to be able to accomplish in that space. And researchers have identified a couple kinds of aspects of our space or types of objects that we might find in a space that that affect the way we think in that space. And one phrase that's used to describe these that I love is evocative objects. You know, if you can call to mind your own classroom or your own workspace and think about what you see, you know, when you look around, are there cues of identity, you know, who you are, cues and signals and signs that remind you of who you are, and in particular your role in that space, you know, as a thinker or creator or scholar, and are there cues of belonging, cues that remind you of valued groups that you belong to, and that you're even if you're alone in that space in that moment, you have this larger connection to a bigger group. And so I think it's useful to think about spaces through that lens also. When you walk into a space, are there signs and signals that tell you you can accomplish what you are setting out to do in this space, and can you connect to other people and feel welcome in this space? So that's one way to look at the spaces that we're in every day.
By the way, for our live audience, maybe you want to take a quick sip of water.
Yes.
I'm going to re-identify for our live radio audience. We are live at the UW River Falls Student Center, and we are talking to Annie Murphy Paul about her book, The Extended Mind. Thanks for listening to WRWFM. I'm wondering, there's just a ton here. And by the way, we'll take questions from folks here. at the Student Center in about, maybe 10 minutes from now. So we'll get your questions ready to go. One of the most difficult things, I think, to do on a college campus is to stop doing something. So how can an institution, you know I'm right, how can an institution like UW-River Falls implement changes that reflect the expanded mind concepts?
Oh, gosh. Wow. Yeah, I've had people ask me, if you could design a school based on the extended mind, what would it look like? And I mean, I've been so excited at about the enthusiasm about the book shown by Chancellor Gallo. And so I'm counting on you, actually, to implement all these ideas, to be the one to put them into action. But I would, well, just to go in order through the way I look at it in the book, I mean, are we bringing the body into, I would ask, are we bringing the body into learning? Are we allowing students time and space to engage in physical activity? Are we even bringing that into the classroom and how we teach, say, math or science? And in the book, I go into, you know, how you can actually use physical movement to capture abstract ideas and in demonstrating scientific concepts, for example, we can give our bodies an experience of, say, concepts in physics, rather than having it all remain sort of totally cerebral and intellectual, and that actually helps students understand and remember and apply those concepts more effectively. So that would be one element of how one could reinvent the university in the mold of the extended mind. Another would be, how much are we bringing in nature into our buildings, and how much are we sending our students out into nature? Another would be, do we have lots of opportunities for what's known as cognitive offloading, which is the process of taking information and ideas out of our heads and putting them out into physical space, which might be a big whiteboard or a bunch of post-it notes.
Robert Caro did that.
Yes,
the historian,
yes,
who I adore.
Yes.
Didn't he have his walls filled with paper?
An incredibly elaborate outline of his books. And one imagines, I mean, his books are so dense and so sweeping, maybe he couldn't even have conceptualize them without having it, you know, actually outside his head that way. And that's another kind of bias that I think we participate in our culture, that smart people, geniuses, do it in their heads. You know, we admire people like memory champions who can remember all kinds of things without consulting a written record, or chess grandmasters who can play out games in their heads. But in fact, the research suggests that we think more effectively and more efficiently when we take all that stuff out of our heads and put it out onto space. So I would, you know, in this ideal university, I would want there to be whiteboards everywhere and lots of post-it notes. And then finally, you know, thinking about how we think with other people. And of course, this is something that's been at the core of university's missions from the beginning. It's a place where people come together to teach and learn together. But there are ways in which we haven't always done that in as well as we might. And I'm thinking here about, there's a chapter in the book about learning from experts. And of course, that is the university model, right? Is that the instructors are experts, the students are novices, and the novices learn from the masters. But the problem with this, and it's just inherent to the way our minds work, is that the very thing that allows experts to be experts is that they have automatized a lot of their knowledge. They actually no longer think about it consciously, and that's how they're able to do what they do so quickly and easily and readily. But that same factor, that same process that makes them experts, makes them in some ways you know, not ideal teachers for novices, because they're no longer conscious of what they know. So there's some techniques that I write about in the book about breaking down what an expert knows, becoming in a sense a more legible model for the student. It's really up to the instructors, and I have taught myself, and I know how difficult it is to explain something that you've become so accustomed to doing. It's really on the, it's the responsibility of the instructor to make themselves a very legible model for the student. And I think there's a lot of research in the science of learning that is opening up how that's, how it's possible to do that.
I thought it was interesting to also read about mimicry, you know, and learning that way, as you say, learning from the masters. But our society is such where everything's got to be original.
Exactly.
Which is really, when you are trying to learn something, it's so defeating and deflating.
Right.
Because you're expected to come up with the, it's almost like you're on your own, in a sense. Mm-hmm, but when you think of how many times you, as a reporter, as you use my example as a broadcaster, but as a print reporter, I'm sure that you probably, as a young reporter, probably mimicked some of the older reporters in your newsroom.
Yeah. No, as a young writer, I read my favorite writers over and over again, almost to get the rhythm of their voice in my head, you know, and I've probably written a lot of really bad, you know, Annie Dillard, but until I developed my own voice. But you're right, Kathy, that we have placed such a premium in our culture on originality, as if originality can just spring out of nowhere. Actually, we you know, there's a much older tradition before that that obsession with originality that rooted education in the imitation of masters, and the idea was that you imitate the greats, you know, until you know that know the process inside and out, and then you can add your own twist or your own sort of novel element to it. But I think we need to get away from our fear of, or our the way that we kind of look down upon or scorn imitation, and recognize that as one of the best ways that humans have for learning.
I asked about if you had a magic wand, what would the perfect university look like using your concepts? But can folks in the audience start practicing some of the elements you've touched on tonight? And how would they start?
Yeah, how would they start? Well, so to start, to go back again to the body, because I really think so much starts with the body. One practical application of the interoception research that we talked about is to use mindfulness meditation, you know, the body scan where you're paying curious, open-minded, non-judgmental attention to whatever is going on inside your body. Use that as a kind of way to check in with yourself periodically, to figure out and listen to what's going on inside you, and not to always be, you know, directing your attention outward, but occasionally to be looking within and seeing what there is to learn from that internal flow of sensation. I think gesturing, as we've talked about, feeling free to gesture and even encouraging other people to gesture. You know, I do this with my sons. I have two boys who are 13 and 16, and when they're trying to explain something difficult, I'll sometimes say, try moving your hands when you say that, you know, because that gives you that sort of that additional channel for expressing and working things out. Physical activity, building that into the workday and the school day, as opposed to separating it. Again, the way we separate mind and body means that we often separate physical activity from intellectual activity. You know, we might go to the gym after work, but what if we incorporated bursts of physical activity into our day? We'd actually see the beneficial effects for our thinking. So then in terms of things we can do right now with our spaces, I would say look for those cues of belonging and identity, those evocative objects that you can surround yourself with at home. Look for opportunities to engage in that cognitive offloading whenever possible. Get your ideas and the information in your head out of your head onto physical space. And then finally, remember that we are fundamentally social creatures, and that a lot of our best thinking is activated by social interaction and by the motivation that comes along with wanting to communicate something to another person or tell a story to another person. And we miss out on all of that when we imagine that thinking is just something we do by ourselves in a room.
This is your opportunity to join our conversation. We've had a two-way conversation, which has been great, but I want to extend the invitation to the audience here at the Student Center to join the conversation. Don't be shy. If you have questions, raise your hand. Rick and Kelly
have microphones, and they're going to go fan out. So raise your hand if you would, please. Chancellor Gallo will get the first question. Only fair. Only fair. This is her party. So we'll give you a mic. Thank you, Chancellor.
Well, thank you too so much. This has just been amazing, and I've enjoyed every second of it. And one thing I wanted to say is that at UW-River Falls, we began as a normal school. So teacher education is what we're known for and is a strength. And we are also very good in Montessori studies. So we have a master's program in Montessori studies, and our first ever doctorate program, our EDD, has been in Montessori studies. So I wanted to ask you, is that Montessori studies and the way that Maria Montessori's pedagogy has developed, is that something that is right in line with the extended mind?
It absolutely is, and I say that as a former Montessori student myself. She was an amazing pioneer, way ahead of her time, and every single category of the extended mind that Kathy and I have been discussing tonight is found in Montessori education. There's so much attention to the body, to physical movement, to the setting. I think that's even maybe the word that she uses, to the physical environment in which students learn, all the work with material objects and feeling things and moving them around. And I can remember tracing my letters with the little sand kind of, sandpaper letters. And of course the social element that children learn through play and through interacting with other people, and that learning is really about relationships. So I'm a huge Montessori fan, and I think she's absolutely incredible when you think about how many of her pioneering ideas have been borne out by science a century later. It's really, I think it's a wonderful thing that Montessori, the spirit of Montessori, is alive here at River Falls.
We have a question over here. What's your first name?
I'm Jamie. I'm a professor here. As I listened to you, I was thinking about a conversation I had with my son driving yesterday. He said, "Mom, we're reading Shakespeare," and he said, "they're reading it out loud, and it has no meaning to me. It's just a bunch of words." Mm-hmm. He said, "I need to see people moving. I need to see actions and expressions." And so it got me thinking about differences. We often hear, why can't they read their books? Why do they need a video? Mm-hmm. As we think about education, is it a generational thing, or is it really truly this idea that we need to see people's movements, that we need to see expressions, that's all part of learning for, and could be even more vital for some people?
Yeah, gosh, I would say your son is right on. Plays are meant to be performed, right? And at least it's being read out loud, and it's not even just, it's not remaining just dry words on a page. But there's a section in the book where I talk about how it is that actors, professional actors, are able to memorize so many pages of lines in their scripts and remember them so accurately. And it turns out that a key element of their ability to do that is that they tie their memory of the words to the actions that they're moving, that they're committing with their bodies, and as they enact the play, and that many actors will not even try to learn their lines until the play has been blocked and they know how they're going to be moving. So I don't know, maybe your son can bring in this, the scientific findings that back up his intuition. But to your question, I think it is the case that I don't want to reference learning styles here, because many of you may know that idea of learning styles has been debunked. But certainly there are people who learn differently, and who have learning differences. And what I've noticed is that many of them are almost like avatars or champions of the extended mind, because they learn differently, or differently from the way that is usually practiced in our schools. They've had to become very resourceful in the way they use extraneural resources. They may develop their own systems of flashcards, you know, or ways of remembering that that don't rely just on the brain. So I find that actually people who have learning differences are models, in a sense, of effectively using the extended mind. At the same time, all of us, those who are, you know, neurotypical or not, benefit from bringing in as many different sort of channels of learning and information as possible. So I'm sure that if your son were able to persuade his teacher that, you know, we should be acting out Shakespeare and not just reading it aloud, that everyone in all of the students in his class would benefit and not just him.
I'm glad you brought up those who learn differently, because mm-hmm. I was thinking about that as I was reading your book, and I thought, gosh, I wonder if folks who learn differently have a, quote, learning disability, mm-hmm. using that old language, mm-hmm. ADHD, maybe they're on the spectrum. Mm-hmm. I mean, are they ahead of us in using some of these concepts?
Yeah. You know, that makes me think, Kathy, of the research on, you know, we were talking about fidgeting and how that can help people stay alert and on track. And research on students who have ADHD has found that the relationship between the intensity of their movement and the effectiveness of their cognition, actually, you know, they rise in tandem. So the more intense their movement, the more effectively they're thinking. And that just goes so against this old-fashioned idea that you've got to sit still, you know, you've got to settle down and sit still in order to think. Lots of people, and I would even say human beings as a species, need to move in order to think, you know, which is such a different kind of mindset from the one that has prevailed in our schools.
Let's go back out into the audience. Another question?
We have a lot, but we'll have time for everybody, right? So.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
I'm glad you have good questions, by the way, I'm glad you're not shy. Rick, there you go. Your first name?
Catherine.
Hi, Catherine.
I'm wondering if you envision how we might be sitting here differently, like in this model, because I heard of a teacher years ago who had his kids on balls. I think he taught fifth grade.
Uh-huh.
And just the spine moving around and in a way the body gets to fidget in a sense.
Yeah.
And we don't have back issues that go for decades of sedentary work life.
Right.
I know I think President Lincoln had a standing desk, so he was way ahead of his time. But I mean, what would we be all look like? What would we look like in a different model sitting here tonight?
Yeah,
it would
be
chaotic.
I mean, I'm just saying. It wouldn't have to be noisy.
It could be a lot of fun. Yeah, you know, there are things called, and I'm not crazy about this phrase, activity permissive classrooms. And I think even that phrase tells you where we're starting from, that like in most classrooms, activity or physical movement is not permitted, you know, but in activity permissive classrooms, often students can sit or move or stand in whatever way makes them feel comfortable. So some might be sitting on the floor, some might be bouncing on like a yoga ball, some might be at a standing desk. And it's true, it's hard for us to wrap our heads around that, right? Because our picture of a classroom is students sitting in rows, sitting still, and that's our idea of how learning works. But we're gonna have to, I think, readjust or reimagine what learning looks like. And I'm thinking in particular of the changes that have been implemented in a lot of high school and university science classes, which again used to be taught, you know, with the lecturer on the stage and at students sitting in rows, and it turns out that students were actually not learning very much that way. And so now when you go into a classroom that has embraced some of the new methods that are inspired by the science of learning, you'll see students in small groups talking to each other. Sometimes they'll be writing on a whiteboard, they'll be heads bent over something, you know, together collaborating, talking. The instructor might be circulating, listening in, you know, trying to hear if kids are engaging in misconceptions or where they might need some help. And that kind of more active, dynamic, socially oriented classroom, I think we're going to see more of that, because that is really how human beings are wired to learn.
Another question, way in the back.
Hi, my name is Mike, and for, I just think it's a really an amazing confirmation of some of the things that I've been talking about with my, in, with my wife and some folks in town here about the benefit of having like walking and talking meetings and how it's so much less stressful than sitting and looking at each other face to face, especially when you're talking about hard things.
Yes.
So incorporating that into difficult conversations, mm-hmm. Walking together side by side, looking in the same direction, and then all of the physical and the physiological and emotional benefits of moving, your neurons firing faster and getting that new fresh oxygenated blood into your system, mm-hmm. as you're coming up with, like my, I think of all of the wonderful ideas and conversations that we've had walking mm-hmm. and looking together in the same direction versus having those challenging, hard conversations and awkward, long, awkward silences, sitting there looking at each other, trying to figure out what to say, but instead you're outside and you're in nature and you're moving
yeah.
and you're, so I think I'm really grateful for your work and I'm excited
yeah.
to learn more about that.
Thanks for your statement.
That's beautiful.
Appreciate that.
Yeah.
I find that my best conversations with my teenage sons happen when we're in the car, right? We don't
yes.
have to look at each other. Eyes on the road.
Don't have to look at you and see what that face he's making. Just keep stay straight
where
ahead,
I'm making.
Straight
ahead. Rick, do you have a question over there?
Yeah. Hi, I'm Davida.
Hi.
And a former professor of yours, remember?
Yes.
So I'm.
Wow.
I have a question about.
But was I okay? I just want to know. That.
Oh, I it was like my first year. I probably wasn't okay. So we both did our best. I have a question. Everything in the book that I've read, like, oh, that's so true. Oh yes, nature. Oh, the one thing that I kind of. Is this true? Was the gut instinct thing?
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Because I kind of wondered about things
chapter.
Like
I'm glad you kept reading.
Implicit bias and other things that sometimes mm-hmm. people's gut instinct
oh, yeah.
is really off base and confirmation bias and all that kind of
yeah.
stuff. So I just wondered if there's a way of detecting, you know, what of that gut instinct is really helpful and what is not so helpful.
Yeah.
Excellent question.
That is a really good
yeah.
question. Yes. Yeah, so I would say that the information that's shared with us through our bodies, through our interoceptive sense, is just that information, and it's one source or one stream of information that can help us inform our decisions, and it's one that we don't want to leave out, we don't want to ignore or suppress, you know, but it's also not going to steer us reliably in the right direction every time. So just like, certainly our conscious minds can also lead us astray, and we need to sort of carefully test, you know, against the real world what our assumptions and our expectations are and our beliefs are. I think, you know, and I suggest some ways in the book that we can treat our interest, the information that we get through our interoceptive sense in that same open-minded but skeptical way. So, for example, some people rely on their interoceptive sense to make investing decisions. And actually, Kathy, you mentioned this study that found that the most successful, meaning the investors who made the most money on a London trading floor, were those who were most interoceptively attuned. So those who were in this case, best able to identify when their hearts were beating. And that to me was a fascinating result because we think that, you know, it's something like, being a financial trader is that's for the big brains, right? That's an entirely kind of, you know, cerebral activity. But actually, it was those traders who were most in touch with their bodies who were most successful, in part because they were things happen on the trading floor so quickly that our conscious minds are actually too slow to keep up. But if they could rely on a gut instinct that was, there's nothing really woo-woo about it. You know, it's really based on for them, many years of experience having seen these situations play out before and then using their bodily signals as a very sensitive antenna, you know, to draw on that long store of experience. But so
for those who might want to, you know, use their interoception to guide their decisions, I suggest keeping an interoceptive journal where you note down how you're feeling when you're contemplating a particular decision. And then later on, you know, when you see how that decision has played out, take a look back at how you were feeling and see, was there a pattern there? Was there a connection? Was my interoception guiding me correctly? You know, so I definitely, the human mind is so susceptible to bias and to shortcuts that lead us astray, you know, so we always have to be careful of that and wary of that. But I do think that our bodily wisdom can provide another source of information that can inform our thinking.
So can the body be more rational than the brain?
Yeah, I know. It goes against our notions that that the body is irrational and animal-like and has nothing to contribute to intelligent thinking. But it may be that the body can cut through some of those cognitive biases and heuristics that so afflict the conscious mind.
Say a reminder, by the way, if you're just tuning in, thank you, by the way, for listening to WRFW-FM. We are live at the Student Center, and we are having a conversation as part of the inaugural week activities for Chancellor Gallo. Annie Murphy-Paul is with us, and we're talking about her excellent book called The Extended Mind. And we've got questions from the audience here at the Student Center, and I want to go back out. Yes, sir? Your first name?
Yep, my name is Mike. And first of all, Kathy, congratulations on the Minnesota Broadcasters Hall of Fame. This is a well-deserved honor, and I think I could speak for everyone here saying you're a great representative of the broadcasting profession and a fantastic Falcon.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. I'm shocked. I appreciate that. Thank you so much.
All right. So I'll have you sign my Kathy Werzer fan club card later. But so Annie, thank you for coming here tonight. I've got two questions for you. One is, the university is about to embark on building a new science and technology education and research center.
Yeah.
So it's going to have space for classroom, for laboratory, for collaboration. Mm-hmm. What one or two things would your research suggest that the physical plant should have designed into it in order to facilitate this expanded mind learning set?
Gosh. Well, I think I'd go back to what we were saying earlier about, are there spaces that support the different kinds of thinking that we need to do to have a sort of fully rounded academic and intellectual experience? Are there spaces where students can be protected from distraction, but also spaces where students can gather and engage in that socially extended mind? Are there lots of places to engage in cognitive offloading? Are there lots of cues of belonging that greet students as soon as they come in? Is there natural light? Are there views to nature? And finally, we haven't really talked about this as much. Is there a sense in which students can feel ownership of this space? Do they feel like it belongs to them, that they have some control over it? You know, it turns out that, and Kathy mentioned earlier, this trend.
Hoteling.
Which is this idea that you come into your office, the desk you had yesterday is not the desk that you have today, and it won't be the desk you have tomorrow. And it just seems to me that drawing on the research again, we have such a need to feel ownership and control over our space that I just don't think that that is ever going to create the ideal kind of place to do our thinking. And as I say, this is all up in the air these days. We're all trying to work this out and figure out how this will go. But if there are ways to allow students to personalize an area that is theirs, that makes it feel like it's their turf in some fashion, I think that would be a really beneficial thing to include.
And you had two questions, I believe. Was that right? I thought you said you had two questions. That was the first.
Well, I didn't want to monopolize the conversation. so the second question I have is, is related to sort of the differences that people have, not in learning so much, but in terms of being comfortable when they're doing that. So so I have an experience with working with people who are very outgoing, right? So very engaged. They want to be interacting with people, collaboration, you know, and then I have other people that I work with who are very introverted. Mm-hmm. And the mere thought of having to engage in some sort of group activity or a social activity, even going out to lunch, is difficult because their comfort space is to curl up in themselves and look at their phone and put their head down and hope nobody speaks to them.
Yeah.
So how do we think about providing a comfortable space for people when, you know, they have all these other activities which really might push some of those folks right out of that comfort space?
That is a good question.
That is a good question, Mike. And I think especially, I've spoken at a lot of universities over the last year and a half since the book came out, and I hear the same thing over and over again. I heard it here in my conversations with faculty, which is that COVID has really, it has really done a job on students' levels of social comfort and ability and willingness and desire to connect with each other in person. And so that puts us at a crossroads, right? It's like, we know that people vary on this continuum of extroversion to introversion. And I'm a bit of an introvert myself, and I would want that to be respected. But at the same time, I think, you know, if there's one thing I've learned from 25 years of reporting on psychology, it's that we don't always know what's best for ourselves. And in particular, it's very easy to avoid experiences and situations that make us uncomfortable. But that's not always the best tack. And it's not always the best tack for us as teachers and parents and leaders to allow students to do that. So I think of this research, it's related, not exactly on point, but being done at the Yale Child Study Center, which looks at anxious children, children who suffer from anxiety, and what is known as parental accommodation. So the natural thing to do as a parent, you know, if your child is anxious, is to, you know, make accommodations for them to prevent them from feeling anxious. You don't want your child to feel anxious. But it turns out that over-accommodation is exactly the thing that makes children's anxiety worse. And so what is the more effective, and what's so interesting about the Yale program is that they don't give therapy to the children, they give therapy to the parents. And they teach the parents, and it's hard to do. They have to practice and they have to learn how to not accommodate their children's anxiety, which is often social anxiety, you know, kids who don't want to go to school or don't want to engage in peer activities. And so I've been thinking a lot about, you know, our students, through no fault of their own, because of a global pandemic, were thrown into this situation where they didn't have a lot of the normal experience, social experiences of kids their age. And now the world is opening up again, and they kind of want to stay in their safe place, you know? And I think we need to, of course, respect and gently, you know, be understanding of that impulse, while at the same time doing everything we can to draw them out and to reacquaint them with the joys and the benefits of interacting with their peers and with their instructors, because that's what we're all here for, right? I mean, that is the best of what a university can do, is bring people together to learn and to teach and learn together, you know? So I want to recognize what you're saying about the differences among people, and also recognize that we've had this cataclysmic event in our society that has led a lot of people to withdraw from social interaction. And everything I've learned from researching this book is that relationships and social interaction are at the heart of learning, and we need to keep it there at the heart of learning.
Well said. Sir.
Yep. Hello, thank you both. My name is Jeff, and I'm on the teacher education faculty here. I know for a fact there's at least one table of young teacher candidates from my psychology of teaching and learning class.
Fantastic.
Back here. And I hereby deputize both of you to grant them 5 extra credit points if they take the mic, if they'll take the mic and ask a question. I have two also, since we've established a precedent.
Okay, fine.
I found myself making notes in the margins quite often about rediscovering or breathing some new life into some old concepts. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of children would suffer less if we remembered that old thing called scratch paper when they were doing math. We've kind of done away with some of those sorts of things. And that manipulatives are necessary for teenagers and college students, not just young children when they're doing things like mathematics and so on. It's a little bit ironic that some of the greatest improvisers in jazz said their ticket to originality was imitating and doing exactly what somebody before them had done. Mm-hmm. So two quick questions. One is, have you seen or are you anticipating the popularization of the concept and the potential abuses that come with it? I'm thinking of Howard Gardner's Multiple Intelligences, which did a lot of good and lit up a lot of classrooms in good ways, but some unintended consequences. Mm-hmm. You know, we can put an argument in a picture and not really, and drawing pictures is a wonderful thing, even for an argument, but you know what I mean? It's sometimes there were some abuses.
So unintended consequences, go ahead.
Yeah. The second question is a little bit more esoteric. Should we let you tackle that one?
So first of all, I should be so lucky, right, to have my idea, have this idea.
You make a lot of money.
But you're absolutely right that along with that kind of popularity comes a misunderstanding. I will say many of the most enthusiastic readers of the book have been teachers, instructors, professors. I think it really speaks to, you know, and a lot of them have said exactly what you were saying, that like, you know, this book just sort of reminded me of all the things that I'd already found my way to or ideas that were already, that I already saw the validity of, but now I have this scientific framework to kind of put it into and evidence to support it. But I do see already some misunderstandings or misinterpretations, and the one I'm thinking of in particular is the idea that now that students can Google anything, they don't really need to, you know, store anything up here, right? Which would be kind of you might see that as the logical conclusion of the extended mind, but we know from cognitive science and psychology that that's absolutely not the case, that in order to learn, to think, to understand, to come up with new ideas, we need a whole lot of information stored in our heads. And the comparison or the analogy that I always draw or the metaphor that I always draw on is like, okay, say you had a tool, a device that allowed you to look up every word in a foreign language that you needed it as your need for that came up. You know, are you then a speaker of that language? If I could look up every word of Russian, you know, as I needed it, do I then speak Russian? No. In order for me to be a fluent speaker of Russian, I would need to have committed to memory hundreds or thousands of vocabulary words, the structure of the language. You know, I would need to know the idioms and the way that native speakers use that language, and all that would have to be stored inside my head. At the same time, I've also, you know, to argue almost the other side of that, I've argued, I wrote an op-ed for the Washington Post that argued that maybe we should think about making all tests and exams open book these days, because it's once you start thinking in the mode of the extended mind, it's like it starts to be very odd that we deprive students of exactly the tools and resources that they would use in the real world to solve problems. We deprive them of all those, you know, they can't talk to their neighbor, you're not really supposed to move around or, you know, gesture while you're taking a test, and you can't draw on all these amazing digital resources we have that put so much information at our fingertips. So what is that telling us other than, you know, a student's ability to memorize? What we really want to know is how is a student going to go out there into the real world and solve problems using all the tools at their disposal? So, you know, I think it's the theory of the extended mind is a really generative idea that can go in so many different directions, and I do hope for it that it doesn't get abused or distorted in ways that that make it less helpful.
Your second question, sir, you said it was esoteric.
Well, yeah, I think it's a little more esoteric. By the way, the quizzes that those students take are all open source. That includes each other, so
oh,
they can
cool.
collaborate
oh,
on those
that
as
is
well.
Cool. Oh, wow. That's really neat.
And I also wish you the best success. I think there's great potential here. I hope it has multiple intelligence-like success and that you do get very rich, because there's a lot to help us out from what you offered here, really. The other one has to do with the lovely use of metaphors. I mm-hmm. like to talk about mind in terms of metaphors, the switchboard, the information processing computer, and the muscle. There's some converging fields from quantum physics to cognitive psychology and neuroscience that believe that the brain is more holographic, perhaps, than just being an information processor. Things like every tiny nano speck of the brain contains all of what is everywhere else in the brain,
oh,
those
wow.
kinds of things. And they're getting some traction. I just wondered if you've heard
oh,
of
gosh.
The holographic
that
mind or
a,
other
that
metaphors.
That is esoteric. No, I've never heard that before. That is a fascinating idea. Where are you reading about this in journal articles, or like is this how
Yeah, there's some journal articles. A little bit would be considered a bit fringe by the scientists, but they're real physicists that have gone
okay,
rogue
I mean,
and that kind of thing.
Is it still sort of a scientist kind of idea, or is it out there in the world being sort of explained by science writers like me?
I would say yes, but again, I don't know the writers themselves well enough to know if they've been sort of kicked out of the academy in order to say uh-huh. what they've been saying, but
uh-huh, uh-huh.
they look legitimate and credible to me. They're real physicists and real scientists.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Wow, that is interesting.
This is why I knew when we get question and answer from audience mm-hmm. members, it's always much more enlivening than just me asking you questions,
right.
So thank you so much.
Yes.
I have a question way in the back of the room. Hello.
Hello, welcome. My name is Deborah, and I'm a musician and a music educator. I'm currently on staff teaching piano and also conducting choirs. So I was just wondering what background you might have in music and music pedagogy and any understanding of what goes on in ensembles in terms of gesture, movement, the physicality of making music, and how that may contribute to all of these learnings because of all the extra movement. So I was just kind of curious about what your background in that might be. And I was also curious whether you and others might think about how the impact of that, the involvement of the arts, especially the music and dramatic arts, but also visual art, could be combined with the STEM, all of the STEM pieces, to make that much more holistic view mm-hmm. and perhaps even be the catalyst that pulls people out of their little shells, or their quiet little, you know, I'm in a fetal position at the moment because I'm too, exhausted or too scared to go out, mm-hmm. and how that might be a catalyst for that. If you have any commentary on any of that, please.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, I mentioned earlier that some of the most enthusiastic readers of the book have been educators and teachers of various levels. And the other group of people who seemed to get this book right away were people in the arts. And when I thought about that, it made a lot of sense, because artists of every stripe, musicians, actors, visual artists, have always worked with their bodies, thought with their bodies. They've always worked with space and been sensitive to space. And of course, they've always collaborated and worked with other people. So, and that this is actually what I like so much about the extended mind, and I feel like I can say that because it's not my idea to start with, is that it's not so much, in a way, it's not so much a new idea. It's reminding us of what was always true and what we never should have forgotten, which is that we are not just brains on legs, we have bodies, we are completely, embedded in our bodies, we're ensconced in physical spaces, we're intimately connected to each other in these social networks, and all of those things help us think, not just this, lump of tissue in our head. So the arts has always gotten that wisdom and never forgotten it, so I think it's sort of a natural fit with the extended mind. But I don't personally have any background in music, and I wonder if if the microphone is still near her, if I could turn it around to you and ask you what you, how you feel the body plays into musical education or musical performance, like what's that relationship?
It's fascinating because it starts with steady beat, heartbeat, mm-hmm. being able to keep people together. Mm-hmm. It continues with listening to each other and hearing each other, both either vocally or instrumentally. Mm-hmm. It continues on with movements that match the maybe the level of the pitch that you're singing. And you can do that in vocal warm-ups. You can do that in instrumental warm-ups. It includes, you know, when you think of the visual of a marching band, you know, the movements that they're making, the choreographed movements that they're making on a field. And how that's fitting with the music that they're playing. Mm. It continues with when you start with really young children and you're trying to help them learn how to keep that steady beat and how to hear where the melody is going up or down and how they can show that with their body. Mm. And it continues even into things like piano playing where, you know, you're looking at the notes on the page going one direction like this. But then what you're doing in reality is actually a three-dimensional piece, moving your hands this direction and that right. direction and the hands independently. And so there's a tremendous amount of movement, even though it is maybe quiet movement and isn't, you know, enormous.
Interesting. We have about 10 minutes left. I want to make sure I have all the questions. Thank you, by the way, for that. We have 10 minutes left. So I just want to make sure that we really get our questions in. I have a question over here, and then we have a question here. So
we have
more.
To allow the student here to have her question, because she's going to get five extra
I'm
points.
I'm going in that direction. I'm going in that direction. Don't worry.
She needs
to get to you.
5 points.
I'll make it quick then. Hi, I'm David. I love the book. The gesturing stuff, really, every time I move my hands now, I think about the book. So thank you for that. But I wanted to ask about the imitation. I want to come back to the conversation about imitation, which I found fascinating. You know, I think about what we do in higher education. We talk about the taboos of imitation from day one. We scare students to death about plagiarism. We talk to them all the time about plagiarism to an extreme.
Right.
We value original research. We tell students you must do original research for your capstone course. We value faculty original research over any kind of duplicative research. We value single authored publications over, I mean, it just goes on and on and on. And so it's a whole cultural challenge, right? And I think people are ultimately discouraged to try to replicate other people's work and improve upon it. Mm-hmm. And so in reading the book, I got the impression, and maybe I misinterpreted this, that this is more of an issue in kind of the United States or maybe the Western part of the world, and other parts of the world, they've kind of come around to valuing this. So. Mm-hmm. You know, following the two-question rule here.
Actually, we're down to one.
Okay, well, there'll be two back. Is that legitimate, first of all? Did I interpret that right? And secondly, more importantly, do you have any recommendations on examples of things that, you know, models that we can follow where we can start changing the narrative in higher education? Mm-hmm.
Good.
And the
you.
First question was about, is this especially
Western
bias against imitation, especially a problem?
In the U.S., it feels like it's got more of a stigmatization.
It does seem like the American culture has a particular obsession with originality. You know, when you think about the people we revere, like Steve Jobs, you know, or inventors and creators who came up with something that no one had ever thought of before. That's like what we really celebrate. But interestingly, if you go way back, I mean, at the very start of Western culture, I write in the book about how the model for Greek and Roman education was based in imitation, and this idea that you would write a poem in the voice of one of the masters, and then you would translate that poem from Greek into Latin, and then you would change the style of the writing. I mean, you would kind of work with this one poem or this one speech so intimately and so thoroughly that you knew that thing inside and out, and you're not creating anything of your own. You're just becoming so familiar with what was understood to be one of the best works that was. The idea of education was to learn from the best and to learn it so intimately that you could then go off and create on your own, but only then, you know. And so so I think we can get in touch with the roots of our own tradition, you know, in re-embracing imitation. And one particular technique for doing that that I write about in the book is offering students models, model exemplars of excellent work by their peers, you know, so that those models feel accessible but also aspirational, you know, because it doesn't seem fair to students to say, produce excellent work, but then not really show them what excellent work looks like, you know. And there's one other advantage to offering models, and this is an example that in the book is drawn from legal education, where students, and this is true across lots of different kinds of disciplines, students are trying to do so many different things at the same time. You know, they may have to learn a new technical vocabulary and a whole new set of concepts, and they're supposed to write their own original contribution. It's like too much. It's the cognitive, it exceeds the student's cognitive load. So if you can break up those different tasks that the student is trying to do and separate them so that they're not having to do it all at once, you can do that by giving them a model to imitate, and then the structure is there. They don't have to come up with that themselves. They're imitating the structure. It's almost like sort of training wheels. Like once they've imitated a model, in the legal education example, it was like, here's a legal memo, write your own memo, but follow the structure that's laid out by this memo. It's like, it's the scaffolding, you know, that, and within that scaffolding, students can be developing skills that eventually they will apply to their own original creation. But we're asking too much of them to be original and innovative right out of the gate, you know.
Yeah, we do have a student question, I understand. Yes?
Hi. Hi. My name is Michaela. I'm a student of Dr. Sherman's.
Michaela, the fact that you're asking a question means that you get 5 extra credits.
Yes, thank you. So I wrote it down so I wouldn't forget. First of all, I'm probably going to buy your book as we leave here today.
Okay.
So it is a double question. And it has to do with online classes, and a lot of students here have to take some online classes. Including myself. So how would you suggest that we as students don't go to Google for everything since it's so readily available?
Yeah.
And then how do you suggest that we fill the void of social interaction with like online classes?
Those are really good questions.
Yeah. Thank you.
To answer that first one, there's actually a really neat trick that I try to do myself, which builds on research showing that curiosity, when we want to know the answer to something, it really actually primes our minds to attend to the answer and to remember it, you know? So when you go to Google something, you're in a state where you're curious, you want to know something, before you Google, try to ask yourself that question and see if you can generate the answer on your own. And then it creates, again, this sort of, it opens, and then once you've done that, you create this sort of gap where it's like, am I right? Was my answer that I came up with by myself correct? And then when you go and Google it, you may be right or you may be wrong, but you're going to remember that interaction, and you're going to have self-generated that answer, and your mind's going to either, you know, incorporate the correction that if you were wrong, or if you were right, you get that kind of dopamine hit of like, yes, my answer was correct. None of which will happen if you just type in that question and never kind of turn that query on yourself, you know? So I think, of course, we all use Google all the time and it's so useful, we're not gonna stop doing it, but we can pause for a moment and ask ourselves the question before we then go ahead and Google.
And the second question was about, if I'm not mistaken, online classes, how can you better connect? Is that correct? How to fill the void.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I know we don't have a lot of time here. I have two ideas. One is try to meet the people that are in your Zoom classes in person whenever you can. The other thing is try to make the interactions on Zoom as much like an in-person interaction as possible. For one thing, you can sit farther away from your camera so that the gestures and movements of your body are visible to the other people, and maybe ask other people to do that so that you get more of a sense of their full-bodied communication. And also, you can turn off what's so really interesting piece of recent research that if you turn off the video, and certainly turn off your own video so that you're not looking at your own face, which I think
it's horrible.
Really the worst thing about Zoom. No. But or if you can even talk on the phone instead of meeting on Zoom, it turns out that we pay much closer attention to an audio-only presentation, and we have to listen to tone and, you know, pauses in ways that just get kind of washed out when we're just, like, you know, sitting back watching, like, passively someone on a video. So if you can really tune in to the voice of the other person, I think there's a deeper connection that can be made there.
This is why I love radio over television. Exactly this.
Agreed.
The soul is contained in the voice, 100%. Is what I think. Yeah. We have time for one more question.
It's very short, and I didn't think I was going to bring it up, but, and I can't remember all of it, but much of what this marvelous book does is remind us of old knowledge and wisdom. And the phrase that I learned a few years ago was, and it's Latin, forgive me, salvator ambulando. It is solved by walking. And it was Augustine used that phrase. And then if you Google it, there will be a whole list, including, I think, a couple of presidents who've had it on their desk. It's like this constant reminder of these admirable people to get out there and walk it through till you figure it out.
Yes, yes. I can't say it any better than that. I think we can just leave it at that. Thank you for sharing that that piece of ancient wisdom.
So a reminder, if you've tuned in late and you're listening to WRFWFM, this will be online. We're going to edit it down. It'll be online in the archive, WRFW887.com is where that will live from here on out. Annie, you are an amazing woman. Your book got me thinking differently about thinking. And I thank you for your excellent work.
I'm so glad. Thank you.
Friends, Annie Murphy-Paul. Thank you.